Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. The Utah Supreme Court puts an end to Amendment D, ruling that votes on the amendment will not be counted. Utah started sending ballots by mail to raise turnout. Here's how many use them amid efforts to nix that choice. And lost in transformation, preservationists lament what they see as the gutting of the Salt Lake Temple of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Joining me today, our Salt Lake Tribune news columnist, Robert Gerke. Robert, thanks for joining us.
Hey, good morning, Tom.
Good morning. State Watch reporter Emily Anderson Stern is with us. Thank you.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you. And later on, we'll be talking with senior religion reporter Peggy Fletcher Stack. Robert, I want to start with you. And it's been all Amendment D all the time. You've been reporting on this. Tell us the latest twist and turn. I guess this is the final turn here.
Yeah, it would seem to be. I mean, so we talked about the Amendment D, I think, last week. And at that point, the district court judge had taken it off the ballot. Let's start with what Amendment D does. I'm sorry, got ahead of myself. So in July, the Utah Supreme Court ruled that the legislature couldn't repeal or amend ballot initiatives that alter reform government, that there's a constitutional right that the public has to run a ballot initiative that, and in this case, it was over the anti-gerrymandering initiative. And they said the legislature overstepped its bounds, undid a constitutional right that the public has to run these ballot initiatives, and that they couldn't do that except if there's a compelling state interest. So what that led to, the legislature was not pleased with that. Remember in August, they called a special session to put a ballot or put a constitutional amendment on the November ballot for ratification that would say the legislature, in fact, can repeal or amend any ballot initiative it wants. The plaintiffs who had been suing over the gerrymandering initiative said, hey, wait a minute. The two things they did wrong. One is that when they put the question on the ballot, you know, the one that actually says, do you support yes or no, you know, they included misleading language. They said what it, you know, on the ballot that should be hitting your mailbox sometime soon, it says, you know, do you want to strengthen the ballot initiative process? And they said, well, that's just not what this amendment does. It actually gives up this constitutional right that voters have had in the state since 1900. The other thing that they did was a little bit more obscure, actually. There's a provision in Article 23 of the Utah Constitution that says that that the legislature has to publish the text of the any proposed constitutional amendment in newspapers around the state before it goes on the ballot, and they failed to do that as well. And so the district court judge, as we discussed here on the program before, said, no, you know, you guys did this. This is the language is misleading, Judge Gibson found, and B, you didn't comply with this publication clause. The state appealed that to the Utah Supreme Court on a, you know, filed an emergency petition to the Utah Supreme Court asking them to hear it. And it moved quickly. I mean, on just the other day, we had oral arguments for about 3 hours before the justices. And then within a few hours later, they issued a brief sort of it's called a per curiam ruling, but basically it was just a notification to the parties that, yeah, the justices are upholding the lower court ruling saying, yeah, that this was correct, that the language was misleading, they didn't comply with the publication clause, and the remedy that that Judge Gibson had imposed, which is, she can't take it off the ballot because the ballots are already printed, but basically the votes for and against it are not going to be counted after they're cast in November. So, yeah, it's a big deal. And it also, you know, it could affect Amendment A, because Amendment A, this is the one that the UEA is opposing right now to undo a income tax earmark. This sends all of the income tax money either to public education or social services. This has been in place for 90 plus years. The legislature has a constitutional amendment A on the ballot that would undo that to give them free rein to spend the money as they see fit. They also didn't publish that one. And so it appears likely, it's not official yet, but it appears likely that one will also be taken off the ballot
I want to return to Amendment A. That's because that's heading through the courts as well. So, was this ruling on Amendment D unanimous? I ask that because in your story, you talk about how during oral arguments, the Chief Justice seemed to be trying to find a solution other than nullifying the votes on this.
Yeah, there were Justice Durant, Justice Matthew Durant, Justice John Pierce. They both kind of were trying to, I think, feel around and see if there was a way to, a remedy for this that wouldn't necessarily deprive voters. Because, Justice Pierce said voters should be the ones deciding this, right? Everybody wants that. But in this instance, if it's not a fair election, then you can't really, just leave it to voters to figure out the end result. It wasn't a signed opinion. It was just sort of a note again to the parties. It was four paragraphs long, so it was very brief. The presumption is that it would be unanimous. They said they're going to issue a formal, a longer written ruling later. But this was just notification because there is some urgency to get this resolved. This was sort of a four paragraph notification that said, yeah, this is how we're going to rule and we'll issue the full ruling later. So we'll see. But the presumption is that it was unanimous because there's not anyone saying that they're dissenting from it. And so, yeah, but the full ruling and will come out later. And then we'll know a little bit more about what the impact is potentially going to be on Amendment A. We need to kind of see how they frame their opinion.
You were at the oral arguments, obviously. Can you give us a little bit of a sense, a very brief sense of some of the arguments from the lawyers for and against?
So the state was arguing that the language wasn't misleading. I mean, they said that the amendment that was being proposed by the legislature would strengthen the initiative process in the sense that it would prohibit, sorry, foreign influence, foreign money being invested in ballot initiatives. That was one of the parts of the proposed amendment. And that it would clarify the process or clarify the initiative process because it would say, well, the legislature essentially that the court had created this confusion in its July ruling by saying that the legislature can't amend or repeal government reform initiatives. Well, what are government reform initiatives? We don't, that's a little bit murky. What is amend, how much can they amend it before it becomes, crosses a line? So they said it would clarify it by just saying, yeah, the legislature can do whatever it wants, basically, when it comes to ballot initiatives. So that was the state's argument. The justices really didn't have, they were skeptical. I mean, they questioned the state's attorney back and forth for over an hour and a half. The other piece that they were arguing was that the publication clause, like I said, the Constitution says that they have to publish these in newspapers. And it's explicit. It says newspapers. And they said, well, we put it online. That was just as good as publishing it in newspapers, if not better. And the justices are like, we're kind of textualists. We believe in the Constitution's. We have to do what the Constitution says. We can't just sort of read into it, other words that aren't there. So that was sort of the argument from the state, and the justices were not really, did not seem very receptive to that. Obviously the plaintiffs were arguing that yeah, this is that Judge Gibson got it right at the lower court, that the language was intentionally misleading, and if voters are given an opportunity to vote on this in November, it's going to be they're being tricked into giving up a constitutional right with this language that says, do you want to strengthen the initiative process? So, it was, like I said, about 2 hours, 2.5 hours of arguments, and you could pretty much tell walking out of the courtroom afterward, and that the justices were not really buying what the state was selling, and they were going to most likely go the direction they did. I guess the only surprise I had was how quickly they did it. I thought we would probably not see a ruling until next week, but like I said, they wanted to get it resolved quickly.
And as you said, the ballots already been printed, I guess. So that's that. I guess that would have been the cleanest remedy, right? Just take it off. But the ballots been printed, so now the votes won't count.
Yeah, so when Judge Gibson issued her ruling, one of the requests from the state was if they were going if she was going to rule against them and rule that this was misleading and didn't comply with the constitutional publication requirement, that she allow the ballots to be printed and then they just don't count the votes later, because they were in a position where they had to, in order to comply with federal law that requires them to mail out the ballots to military personnel, LDS missionaries, anybody overseas, they had to get these printed right away. So the ballots are all printed. They have all of the constitutional amendments on them. Obviously, the votes for D will not be counted, and the votes for Amendment A. Again, the direction it seems to be going is that they likely won't count either, but the court still has to play that, let that one play out and hear the and make a decision on that. This is still Amendment A is still in district court, so it's the lower court that still has to decide that, but it will be decided based, I guess, with the guidance of this Supreme Court decision once it comes out.
Yeah, let's talk about that. So Amendment A, that's the education amendment. This would remove the constitutional provision that all income tax goes to education and what social, I guess, some disability services. But the legislature appears to have missed the deadline to get this in the newspapers as well. So I likely that this is going to be voided as well.
I mean, so this earmark for public ed, well, it's been around for 90 plus years. They expanded it a little bit to include higher ed and then include social services. Now the legislature argues that they just need sort of free rein to spend this money how they want. They need the flexibility. So they want to spend income tax money however they want to spend income tax money. So that's Amendment A. It's on the right now it's on the ballot. Excuse me. But as was the case with Amendment D, this publication clause, honestly, I think a lot of people just didn't even know it existed because it's not been consistently done when there have been, excuse me, it's not been consistently done when there have been constitutional amendments on the ballot, but it says that it has to be published in newspapers across the state at least 60 days before the election. And the idea was, we want voters to be able to read the text of the amendment and make their decisions before we do this. But again, it's not been consistently followed, but nobody's ever challenged it. So now that Amendment D, the plaintiffs in the Amendment D case have challenged it and the courts ruled in their favor, the UEA is also challenging the publication compliance for Amendment A, sorry. And so now we're in a situation where the lower court will make its decision on whether or not to kick Amendment A off the ballot, not kick it off the ballot, as we said, ballots are printed, but to not count the votes for Amendment A as well as Amendment D. And it just seems like because the court was pretty convinced that no, it hadn't been published in newspapers 60 days before, and while it had been published online, arguably, that's not a newspaper under the strict reading of the Constitution. And so it seems like the direction it's going to go is that Amendment A will not be counted either, and we'll end up with having to, and basically the court will end up having, or not the court, I'm sorry, the legislature will have to end up running these same amendments again in 2 years, and this time I guess we'll probably comply with the publication provisions that they're required to do.
Well, it's very interesting. I guess our votes on B and C will count in the end. We'll have to see on A.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we have to see if somebody's going to actually step up and challenge those because, it's pretty much a layup, right? The court has given them pretty clear guidance that if they weren't published, none of them were published until after the deadline. And so all it would take really is for somebody to say, we're going to challenge these two, and the court would say, okay, we're going to take them off. If nobody challenges it, I guess it can go forward, but we'll have to see on B and C. But right now, D is off, A is likely going to be off, and we'll have to see about B and C.
Well, this election season doesn't lack for interesting things. So, Robert Gerke, thank you so much for telling us about this.
Yeah, of course, Tom. Thanks.
News columnist with Salt Lake Tribune. You're listening to Behind the Headlines. Before we go to break, some more interesting news, exciting news. Tom Williams with the Fall Fun Drive, and I'm joined by Nick Porath, our chief engineer. This is the last day of the drive, Nick, and we're a lot closer than we were yesterday. We're within striking range now, and on this last day of the drive, we hope that you will go to upr.org, and pledge in whatever amount. You'll help us to meet our overall goal.
That's right. The momentum this morning has been fantastic. It's a great last day to the drive so far, and I'd like to keep this momentum going. And I think all of us here at the station would love that. And you out there can help us with that. UPR.org or 800-826-1495. Like Tom mentioned, it's the last day of the drive, so you know it's a bit of a push today. But you know, when you give to Utah Public Radio, you support the programming you tune in for. Programs like Behind the Headlines. It was originally a program that originated from KCPW that we shared. And unfortunately, after KCPW went off the air, we were able to continue the show, which I'm super, super glad that we've been able to do. But we haven't been able to do that without our listener support.
So if you go to upr.org, you can also look at our fundraising thermometer. We're about a little under $12,000 away from the goal of $60,000. You might think, wow, that's a lot of money, but a lot closer than we were yesterday. Like I said, we're making great progress. And as we approach the finish line, which is this evening, won't you go to upr.org, and pledge? And to help you, help all of us, we have a dollar-for-dollar match. This is a double challenge, so your money is tripled. So Sonia Manuel DuPont and Ryan DuPont, along with Alberto Brisolara and Luciano Di Cibro, put their money together. So up to $3,000. Very generous. When we triple that, that'll really help us to reach that goal by this evening.
I've been here with Utah Public Radio for just over 5 years now, and I don't think I've ever seen a drive where we've hit the goal before the drive ends. We've always fallen a little short. We still end up meeting the goal eventually, but you know, if we can hit that goal before the day is over, that'll be a fun milestone. I would love to see that.
So Nick, we do have Lauren Augustus on the phone here. Lauren is executive editor of the Salt Lake Tribune. Lauren, thanks for joining us.
Good morning. How are you?
Good, good. Well, we're excited here. We're getting closer to our overall goal. So thank you. I think you came on this morning. Thank you for coming on with us here. And we're highlighting here partnerships with Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is one of those. And we have a shared reporter as well. We appreciate the partnership.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's been wonderful to be a partner with Utah Public Radio. And Clarissa Casper is a reporter who's working both in audio and in words. And in my view, she's doing some really excellent local reporting. You know, there's a lot going on up in Cache Valley. I know that your listeners are statewide, and I know that they certainly have access to statewide news and information through you and through our partnership. But really, if we're going to shine a light on the work that Clarissa has been doing, you know, she's talking about ADUs and affordable housing solutions in Logan. She's written about kind of a renaissance, if you will, in local art and in the muralist scene or community up in Cache Valley. And then she's also, you know, talking about economic development. She just wrote this week, I believe, about a historic home right in front of the temple that's going to be turned into a boutique hotel.
Yeah, this is a need we've had definitely for reporting specific to Cache Valley. So now this partnership, Utah Public Radio and Salt Lake Tribune, we're filling that. We're happy to be part of that partnership with you.
Yep, and, you know, your listeners make it possible. You know, we're both nonprofits. The Tribune's a nonprofit. UPR is a nonprofit. But when your folks help in this donor drive, they're supporting quality local news and information. And, you know, I am thrilled to see support for any kind of nonprofit news gathering efforts in Utah. And so hopefully, you know, folks will continue to support and we'll get to that match before the day is out, Tom.
Well, thank you so much. Just a reminder, last day of the drive, we're getting closer and closer to that overall goal. And with your help, we can do that. Please consider going to upr.org, making your pledge. Maybe a little extra gift as well to help us get over the top. Sonia Manuel DuPont and Ryan DuPont, together with Alberto Brizolara and Luciano Di Cibro, have put together a double challenge. So your money is tripled today. We also have double mugs. We're throwing everything here, Nick.
We're
double mugs.
Pulling out
all
the stops.
Those art mugs, two of those for just your contribution of $10 a month. All of that to help us to reach our goal by the end of the day today. UPR.org is the place to go. We'll go to break now and back with Behind the Headlines. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Here's the headline we'll go to next. Utah started sending ballots by mail to raise turnout. Here's how many used them amid efforts to nix that choice. We bring in Salt Lake Tribune State Watch reporter Emily Anderson Stern. Emily, thanks.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Tom.
So this is an interesting story. I guess this came up because the various legislators over the last few sessions have at least talked about and then introduced legislation. It's not been successful so far to restrict or pull back use of mail-in ballots. So I guess the question you wanted to answer is how many Utahns use this?
Right. And, you know, during this most recent legislative session, I looked into doing it. And that specific piece of legislation ended up not really going anywhere. But, as these proposals come up session after session, I thought it was still an important question to answer. Back, you know, in January, February, I looked at state election data, and there really wasn't a ton to show us just how many people were using the ballots they get in the mailbox. Only a few counties were reporting the methods that voters use to vote. Then fast forward to the primary election in June, and the spreadsheets that the state posted to its elections website did show how ballots were submitted. So I started collecting data from that and looked and saw, you know, that not all of them were consistent. So then I started reaching out to counties individually and collecting data from counties. And I ended up getting data from 26 of Utah's 29 counties as to how many people in their counties were using the ballots they got in the mailbox, whether that was sending them back in the mail or putting them in the drop box. And what we found of those 26 counties was that 96.7% of residents there were using the ballots they got in the mailbox. That's over 400,000 voters. The three counties that didn't respond are relatively rural ones. And so those results include all of Utah's largest counties and, you know, many of Utah's rural counties.
You talked to a gentleman who lives in Lucene, works out there, apparently comes into Ogden to supplement his income working in Ogden as well. It's a pretty rural area out there in Lucene. What does he say about mail-in ballots?
Right. He lives out, you know, in the West Desert, in a pretty remote part of Box Elder County. And so if he were to vote in person, he would have to drive with, you know, where current polling places are located, he would have to drive over 2 hours. And so he said if he didn't have the option to vote in the mail, he probably just wouldn't vote at all. It would be difficult for him to get out there to make the time, especially as you mentioned, you know, he's financially pretty tight right now. So that's a lot of gas money. That's a lot of time away from work. A lot of time he'd spend away from his farm or time that he could spend painting in Ogden to make extra money. So he's one of the many voices that probably wouldn't turn out to vote if they didn't have the option to vote by mail.
That's I think replicated in, you know, a lot of those rural counties, right? People, you know, some people at least wouldn't vote if they had to drive a great distance. What are the, in your story, Emily, you have some statistics. There have been some study of this, right? By the way, Utah's the only red state that does this, right? But there's some eight states. What has vote by mail increased voter turnout?
Yeah, and you know, that's actually the reason in the first place that the legislature decided to give permission to all of Utah's counties to conduct their elections entirely by mail. Was back in 2012. Representative Steve Elison from Sandy, who's a Republican, proposed this bill to give that permission. And, you know, as he was talking about it and talking to his fellow lawmakers, he talked about how back then Utah had some of the worst voter turnout in the country. And how, you know, time after time, study of states that allow people to vote entirely by mail showed that it increased voter turnout. And then, you know, if you look at Utah's voter turnout over time, it has trended upward since we moved entirely to vote by mail. We saw all of the counties start using this option around 2018, 2019. And then it became part of state law in 2020. In 2020, and of course, there was quite a there's a presidential election that a lot of people are paying attention to, but Utah saw record-breaking voter turnout at 90.9%, which was, you know, quite a lot more than before all counties were allowed to do voting by mail back in 2008. The turnout for the presidential election was 67.8%. So quite a big jump there between those two elections.
So if it's increasing voter turnout participation, seems like that's what we would want. Why are some Republican legislators wanting to restrict this, pull it back?
Well, a lot of this comes from that election I mentioned in 2020, when former President Donald Trump lost. There were a lot of, you know, rumors, false rumors, frank lies from some people spread about election fraud, and how there and about the integrity of the U.S. elections, etc. And one of the systems that came under attack was voting by mail. And you know, if you think about voting by mail, that can raise questions for people because people are casting their votes privately in their home. When they send it in the mail, the ballot is passed between more hands. But largely, there's really no evidence of fraud when it comes to voting by mail. I mean, it happens from time to time, but largely county clerks catch it. They stop those ballots from being counted. You know, there's a lot of checks and balances in place as to how to ensure that fraud is not committed in voting, including making sure that people don't both vote by mail and then vote in person because there are specific barcodes associated with the by mail ballots. And then also verifying signatures. You know, if you have an ID or license, the state has a copy of your signature and they can check that against your ballot. And, you know, there are a variety of other safeguards in place, but Utah's elections are audited every year. After each election, the legislative auditor's office looks into the election and whether there are places where county clerks in the state and the lieutenant governor's office, which oversees elections, where they can make it more secure. And, you know, if you look at those old audits, every single time the lieutenant governor's office agrees to make those changes. They didn't, last time the auditor, again, did not find evidence of fraud that, you know, some Republicans are saying is happening.
Well, Emily, thanks for telling us about this. And I guess pretty soon active registered voters will be receiving their ballots as usual. So, Emily, before we go to underplayed stories, I want to have you just give me your 1 minute version and we'll have people read this. Just published this morning. Here's the headline. Cox campaign accepted $10,000 from foreign subsidiary as appointee reviewed controversial lithium project. Your story published this morning along with Anastasia Huffam. Give me a very short version of this.
Yeah, an Australian company called Anson Resources had applied for water rights in the Green River last July. One of their subsidiaries registered a lobbyist here in December. And, you know, in May, a few months after she was reappointed by Governor Cox, the state engineer approved the application. But, you know, this was a pretty widely protested decision. A lot of farmers, environmentalists, and even the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation protested whether that was a good decision for the future of the Green River. And so she agreed to reconsider her decision in June. Then the next month, in July, that Australian company, Anson Resources, its U.S. subsidiary, A1 Lithium, donated $10,000 to Governor Cox's reelection campaign. And then earlier this month, the state engineer doubled down and reaffirmed her consent for the lithium drilling project on the Green River.
All right, and much more, of course. Read it at sltrib.com. Oh, as we head toward a break, I want to do our underplayed stories of the week. Right now we have a recorded interview with Peggy Fletcher Stack to end the program. Robert Gerke, what's your underplayed story of the week? Let's see, let's go to Emily Anderson's turn. Your underplayed story of the week.
I will talk about one from this morning in which a judge dismissed a defamation lawsuit against the Millard County Chronicle Progress. It came from a developer in the county that alleged that the newspaper's reporting had turned the community against him, and a judge threw it out.
All right. Check that out at sltrib.com. Robert, do we have you with us? Your unplayed story?
Yeah. Sorry. I couldn't get my mic unmuted there.
Sorry about that.
I think my underplayed story is one that Megan Banta did. And it kind of gets to this tension about air quality versus tourism. And, you know, there's obviously Utah's had air quality issues for years. There's concerns about health. There's been efforts to try to roll it back, but Megan did a piece about how that is now creating a conflict with some of the tourism efforts in the state and along the Wasatch Front and the Colorado Plateau. It's a regional haze issue. It's interesting. It's an important story, and I think it could have an impact on both air quality and Utah's big tourism industry and our, you know, our national parks and playgrounds and so forth. So I check it. I suggest checking that out at sltrib.com.
sltrib.com. Well, Robert Gerke, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to be here.
Thank you. Emily Anderson Stern, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you. Say goodbye to you too. We'll have Peggy Fletcher Sack in the final segment, which is coming up. We bring on, once again, Salt Lake Tribune Executive Editor Lauren Gustis. Lauren, thanks for joining us again.
Sure, Tom. Happy to be here.
So you mentioned, I think some people may not know this, Salt Lake Tribune has gone to a nonprofit model. Tell us about that.
We have. So about 5 years ago, we became the first major metro news organization, newspaper, to transition to a nonprofit. The IRS granted us our status a little quicker than we thought, and we got to work building a board, building gift acceptance policies, helping people understand how the journalism would change. And one of the things that changed is that our posture or our position moved from competition to collaboration. So, you know, we are partners now with Utah Public Radio in large part because, as a nonprofit, we believe that there should be more news and information accessible to more people all across Utah. And that manifests itself in the partnership that we have that we discussed just a few minutes ago with Clarissa Casper, working for both UPR and the Salt Lake Tribune and readers and listeners across the state, but also in collaborations like the Great Salt Lake Collaborative, which brings people more news about the lake across multiple forms, video, audio, words, and in the Utah News Collaborative, which enables partners across the state to share their daily reporting with one another so that, again, more news, more information reaches more people.
A lot of synergy that way, a lot of power in those partnerships, so we appreciate that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll tell you, you know, Tom, I know this is a big day for you at UPR, and the drive is really important to you being able to do what you do and to the sustainability of Utah Public Radio. And, you know, as I chatted with Carrie earlier this week, I let her know I'm a donor. I'm a supporter to Utah Public Radio. I think it's really important that people have multiple avenues, multiple ways for them to get news and information. And, shoot, I've got a family. We're very busy. And one of the things I really like to do is catch up on the news in audio form in the morning, right? We're making breakfast. We're getting ready for school or for work. And it's a great way for me to keep up with what's happening in Utah and what's happening nationally. And so grateful to UPR for all that it does. And I, too, am a supporter.
Well, thank you so much. By the way, I'm a longtime subscriber to the Trib, and I subscribe for the similar reasons that I'm a member of Utah Public Radio. You know, I want to get the content, obviously, but I want to see you succeed, right? So that's the reason to support either the Trib or the Utah Public Radio. So your money's tripled. That's the big news here on the last day of our fall drive. It's some urgency, but we've made a huge amount of progress in the last couple of days. We're about $12,000 away from our $60,000 goal, and this now seems reachable. But we're still $12,000 away. So you can help us by pledging in any amount, and Sonia Manuel DuPont and Ryan DuPont will double your money. And Alberto Brisolaro and Luciano Di Cibro will also double your money. That means that your money will be tripled today. That's an all-day match up to $3,000. And so that'll, with your help, get us to $9,000 more. On this last day of the drive, you can get double mugs. Our art mug, you get two of those for a pledge of $10 a month. And all day, usually this is only in the morning, all day long you get a bag of Cafe Ibis Guatemalan Forest coffee along with two mugs, $10 a month for that. UPR.org to do that. Well, Lauren, thank you so much for being a donor to Utah Public Radio, and thanks for the partnerships.
Of course. Thanks, Tom.
All right, we'll talk to Lauren again a little later in the hour. We'll head toward a break here. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. More coming up with senior religion reporter Peggy Fletcher Stack following this. On this part of Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune, I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune senior religion reporter Peggy Fletcher Stack. Thanks so much for joining me.
Happy to be here.
So this is an interesting story. The headline, Lost in Transformation, Preservationists Lament the Gutting of the Salt Lake LDS Temple. Subheadline, Church Officials Insist Renovation Honors the Past While Looking to the Future. So some controversy about this lengthy renovation of the Salt Lake Latter-day Saint Temple. So I guess this was announced, what, 2019?
It was initially, not the gutting, but the need for a seismic upgrade for the temple. Which everyone agrees was a good idea. No one takes issue with the seismic upgrades, just primarily shoring up the outside of the temple. In 2019, the public, I was actually at a news conference where they talked about preserving the inside of the temple. In fact, taking it back to the way it looked in 1893 when it first opened, because there have been several kind of updated or alterations to the interior since then.
So the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, as far as we can tell, the original intent was pretty preservationist, preserving as much as possible the murals and everything. I guess a decision was made subsequent that no, we're going to go a little more for efficiency, have more rooms where people can experience the endowment. Tell me about that.
The biggest change that happened was that President Russell M. Nelson decided that the church would no longer have what they called live temple rituals. And these were rituals in which patrons move from room to room, kind of stepping up each way after each room. And it was supposed to symbolically express Adam and Eve's expulsion from the Garden of Eden. Then there was the world room and the ultimate return to God's presence. And that was, you know, crafted into the architecture. But these days, the temple ritual, the story of the journey is told in a film or kind of a slideshow presentation, not by a live ritual. I mean, they still had live rituals as recently as 2021 when this was announced in Manti and Salt Lake. But when President Nelson decided no longer to do that, then there was no need for those rooms to move up and all of that. That's when the decision was made somewhere to gut the interior spaces, make it, as you said in your intro, more efficient, and that the live ritual would no longer be done, and it would all be done by in the same way with a film or slide presentation.
What is the church saying? I don't know if they responded directly to that verb "gut," right? But I think they would take issue with that. I guess they'd say they're trying to strike a balance. What are they saying?
Yeah, the church says they were trying to make it more efficient and fit in with other temples, but have a kind of feel of the Victorian era, that they would preserve a sense of that. And they in response to some of my questions, they said that they were trying to balance the needs of preservationists with the need for more efficiency and to make all the temples have the same way of doing it, rather than have, you know, these temples be different. The church put out a news release on Saturday saying it will look like a Victorian era temple, which was never the case after previous restorations, and that they were striking this balance between the past and the future.
So you talked to some other people who do not agree with that, right? Some of them are right. Fairly emotional that they do not agree with what the church came up with. What are they saying?
Well, they're just saying that, you did not need to gut the... Well, first of all, I should say what's left. There are some original things left. One is something called the celestial room, and a couple of staircases, two original ceiling rooms, and the large assembly room on the fifth floor, and most of the terrestrial room. So that's what was preserved. But what's gone is the murals that were painted on the walls. They said they couldn't preserve those, but the preservationists say, well, they could have recreated them. Anyway, the preservationist, most particularly the former executive director of Preservation Utah, says, you know, that this is a tragedy and that not terribly sensitive to the pioneer's craftsmanship. He says, I find it deeply, deeply offensive that churches using these previous renovations, some of which were easily reversible, to excuse the thorough gutting the building has now gone through. And he mourns that loss. He said that the book, Every Stone a Sermon, The Magnificent Story of the Construction and Dedication of the Salt Lake Temple, was on his family's coffee table. He believed that the temple was a sermon in stone, but now it's very similar to, at least in the interior, it's very, very similar to all the other temples. And the church told me that there will be no murals in the newly renovated, newly redone temple interior. So that's all gone. Mm. People are not, patrons will not be able to say, oh yeah, that's where my great-great-grandfather carved this staircase. Or, and beyond that, Jody England Hansen, who was a temple worker up until when the temple was closed, feels especially the loss of the live ceremony. Mm. She called it the theatrical ascension journey, and she said they've turned it into a megaplex movie theater. And so she also, she says, how can we talk about it without weeping? So, yeah, there's some strong feelings.
Yeah, yeah, certainly. You have a quote here from the presiding bishop of the church, Gerald Cossey. He says Salt Lake Temple is a living building with a past and a future. You know,
yes.
He's defending these changes.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, what you would expect that they would do. It's a different perspective on history and preservation. It is a living temple. It is currently, and I mean, will be in use as soon as it's open. And talking to lots of different people, my guess is that not a lot of people will notice the differences. It does take someone, people with some sense of preservation and history, to really see what was lost.
So, Peggy, in your story, you mentioned the Manti Temple, which was recently renovated. Murals, Minerva Tykert's murals, are still there. They're preserved. How did that happen?
Well, actually, in fact, the first announcement in 2021 that the Salt Lake Temple had been, that the live ceremony was done, and that the temple would be changed. The murals were gone, and in that very same news release, they said the same thing was about to happen to the Manti Temple. But then there was a lot of pushback from members in Manti, from people all over, and within about 6 weeks, the church leadership backed away from those changes, and instead painstakingly restored that historic pioneer temple to what it was, and including the murals. The live ceremony is gone, even in Manti, but the rooms are in the same configuration as they had been. And when it was opened, hundreds of thousands of people flocked to see it, to see the Manti Temple, and were astonished by its beauty, all done by its pioneer ancestors of today's Latter-day Saints.
One of the, this is near the end of your story, one of the people you talked to, a preservationist, talked about how this, what's happening in the Salt Lake Temple, represents a flattening of the Latter-day Saint experience. What did he mean by that?
I think that he meant that the once upon a time there were some differences, you know, that lots of people went through the temple rituals via film, but that there were still these other options, and now it's all the same.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he was talking about, that the preservationist, who, by the way, is Latter-day Saint himself, so it's not an outsider making this claim.
Right. So, in the meantime, the Salt Lake Temple, I guess, due at this point to reopen 2026. That's what we're thinking?
Yeah, that's what they're saying. So,
yeah.
We'll see. The date has been pushed back quite a bit, often.
It's been a long project. Peggy, anything else you'd like to say about this story?
No, I am interested in how people will respond to the new interior.
Yeah.
I will be following this story for sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've been talking with senior religion reporter Peggy Fletcher Stack. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio, Salt Lake Tribune. Peggy, thanks so much.
Happy to be here.